You were the only NPR correspondent who spoke Japanese, so it seemed obvious that you would cover the earthquake and tsunami a year ago, but you had a nursing newborn at the time as well as a toddler, and you had only recently recovered from a post-birth disorder that almost took your own life. Were you torn about going to Japan?
Well, it's really hard to leave young children, as you know, just logistically as well as emotionally, but the experience of having a difficult birth and just feeling that my parents' homeland was in such a ravaged state, it felt like a special opportunity, and it wasn't one that I felt like I could turn down. It felt like a gift in a way and a real opportunity to do something that was out of the ordinary, at least for me. And so I figured that my kids would eventually forgive me and that it was really an important thing for me to do.
How about your husband? Did he eventually forgive you?
Well, he was reluctant about telling me to go. At the time, there were questions about aftershocks, and of course, there was a huge lack of clarity about what was going on with the nuclear power plant in Fukushima. So he was concerned primarily about the radiation risk. At the same time, he was extremely supportive and going to take care of the kids for us. And he was ultimately supportive, but also understandably pretty nervous, as was I, about the radiation situation.
What do you remember most about seeing the damage there for the first time?
Oh, it's just unlike anything you could possibly imagine. It was springtime at the time, and so, you know, it's cherry blossom season, which is, of course, you know, legendary around the world in terms of its beauty. You drive to the coastline. A lot of these towns are very isolated. You sort of drive from inland through, like, these mountain passageways to get to the coastline. And the water had pushed in 3.5 miles. And so you get to this point where the landscape just changes like that. I mean, just like in an instant. You're driving towards the coastline, you know, the land is there, and then it's just, it doesn't exist anymore. And not only does it not really exist, it looks like, you know, everything has been pulverized and then left, you know, with mud and seawater, and just everything from the foundation up is just decimated.
Did you have to bring your own supplies? What about the infrastructure by the time you arrived?
Yeah, the infrastructure really wasn't moving except for, you know, the ability to get food and water and those kinds of basic supplies into the shelters. Japan is famously very organized and very systematic, and so it was an extremely organized sort of relief operation. But as far as cell phone service and internet service and buying batteries or getting gas or using an ATM to get cash or any of that, like, none of that existed.
You talked to a lot of people whose lives had been just turned upside down. Also the owner of a soy sauce factory who made you laugh in the midst of all the misery.
After the fact, after my reporting was completed, I think I was left with this sense that of surprise, actually, at how resilient human nature can be under these circumstances. The soy sauce maker was a 9th-generation owner of, you know, a very old soy sauce manufacturing firm. And, you know, he had lost 2 employees, he had lost his house, he had lost his business, and he was just a great storyteller, and he had this sense of humor that took me by surprise. Somebody in that circumstance usually doesn't find it in themselves to be funny, but he was. And I found him to be a real natural leader. I mean, he was somebody who, the day of the earthquake, you know, like hours afterward, was coming up with a plan to how to get the city back on its feet. And there are special qualities like that that shine through about the people that I interviewed that I really hope to give some airtime this weekend when I do this speech.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR's business correspondent. Thank you, Yuki. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you so much.